This is the Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri, and we're on remote with JP Dancing Bear. He's from the Northwest. We're from the East, but we got together to hear him, and we'd love to have an opening poem, Bear.
Okay. This poem is called Making Fire. It's from a chapbook called What Language? Even after this much evolution, the furnace dies and she is cold again. So I go out to the back of the house with its spiders and mosquitoes, where the rusty gas pipes wait. I've tightened, lit, relit, banged and kicked. No rock, no bone in my toolkit works. I snort and swear at the metal box, then look down at the pilot and see the stress crack. Now I know what to do, but I can't remove the rusted plate that keeps me from the pilot. I go down to the hardware store where other men with wide hands pick and prod amongst the pipes and boards, grunt and point their calluses at dream tools. They can't justify the cash. They linger, tell their fantasy scenarios, money no limit, the things they'd buy. I don't belong there. I buy what I came for and go home. In fading light, I fill the crack with the metal repair goo. It's not pretty, and another guy would scoff. But I can smell cooking inside, and I know she appreciates my fire.
The voice of J.P. Dancing Bear. I could listen to him forever, really. Why did you like that poem?
Well, it's based on reality. I lived at one point in a little, not a motorhome, but, a prefab. And so water heaters at the very back in a little closet. Outside, so we have to deal with the weather and go out there and deal with like spiders and all sorts of stuff there.
What I like about it is the ordinariness of it, that this we could not get any more down to earth than filling a split pipe with glue. And it's your the way you honor the everyday things and the domesticity and saying this is as important as anything else. And that's what I find throughout your work. I think I'm on target there, that you find the dailiness of life as miraculous as the Northern Lights. So we're with JP Dancing Bear. Tell us about the lineage of your name and your commitment to that name.
My grandmother was Ojibwe and lived on the reservation in Michigan. And then at one point decided to just get out of there. It wasn't the life she was happy with any longer. But this was back in the 60s, 50s. So, you know, things were quite different. Not that they're that much better now, but they were quite different then. And basically she got a job in one of the mink ranches and put two kids through, you know, through to the end of, they both went into the military, but that's in a nutshell where I come from, what my people are. And then my dad married my mom, who is the other half of America, basically, which has been here since the Mayflower.
But what you were inherited was the gift of song. For sure.
Yeah.
And that is in your veins, whether it came, I don't know where that came from, but it is predominant. So let's hear another poem. Bear, this is the Poet and the Poem.
I will read another early poem called Caliban. And this one has had sort of a life of its own. It gets taught in a bunch of different workbooks and stuff. I have to keep signing waivers for it to be there. Before hatred ate my heart, there was music, my mother's willow music, her dark willow music of wind and wave, there was water singing over the roots of ash, over stones. Mother, I am a dead thing with a voice trained for anything but song. Shackled in magic and pushed down, taught to speak with a tongue that damns me with belly aches. Mother, your songs will die within me. Mother, I am shaped an evil thing. My tears run for the loss of song. My fists clench for you.
But Bear, there's no loss of song. There is no loss of song. What did that come from?
Oh, it came from The Tempest, Shakespeare. And I've always been a big fan of Shakespeare. I love his poems, and primarily what I love is his characters. They're so believable, and they're so, even after 500 years, they're so on point. I love the villains. I love the heroes, and the fools. I particularly love the fools. I think they're awesome.
Well, I'm so glad I asked that, because I was going to get into the antecedents that influenced you, because you are touched by the classical. You are imbued with lyricism. And I was always wondering all of your influences, and I can see this now. I can see Shakespeare in you for sure. So let's hear another. This is JP Dancing Bear. We got him early on the West Coast, and I'm really glad we did. This is The Poet and the Poem.
Okay, now I'll read something a little more recent. I'll read something from, this is of Oracles and Monsters, which came out a couple of years ago. The Last Vision of Cassandra. There was always something on the horizon, a fleet of ships. Cassandra could see where trouble and a blood ocean, a departure at dawn. She could see the burning, the place where dreams catch a flaming arrow and reflect their immolation on waves. And when the boiler explodes, a wall in her cell collapses like genuflecting believers. And she knows this is not escape, just fresh air gushing ahead of her own death.
You know, I don't know that book. Now, you are the author of 5 or 6 books.
16?
Here. This is why you should not go to the internet for information. But I can say some of them. I can talk about the winner of the Slipstream Prize. That was What Language? That was a chapbook. You have Billy Last Crow. You have Conflicted Light. You have Inner Cities of Gulls. Family of Marsupial Centaurs, that was a Josephine Miles Literary Award winner. And you've had The Abandoned Eye, Love is a Burning Building. And we know that you have been the foremost citizen in the Republic of Poetry there could be. You founded the American Poetry Journal, the DMQ Review. You own Dream Horse Press. We'll get to Verse Daily, which is an American icon, after a while. And you were on the radio for 15 years. So I have about 6 books, and there have been 10 more. 10 more. Why don't you get writer's block? What is the matter with you?
Oh, well, I'll tell you a little thing about writer's block. Because I never actually really believed in it. And I totally disproved it at one point. Because 3 of those books were part of a series that I wrote in 2009, which was called The birthday poems is what everybody referred to them as. And back then I was on Facebook, and what I would do is everybody's birthday that day, I would write them a poem. And sometimes that was 5 poems, and other times it was 15. And at the end of a year, it turned, and naively, I did not keep count until the end of the year. And when I did do a count, and then it was like 1500 poems.
That was about the reason you could keep going is because it was about other people. And that is your source of energy. You are a current, and you'll never have writer's block, because that's writer's block is actually lack of ego energy. And when people look back at you and reflect what you've done for them, you'll never be without energy. I mean, look what you did. 1,500 poems about other people?
In 1 year, yes, I know.
In just 1 year. In just 1 year. What do you eat for breakfast? I mean, we want it. Well, I am so happy to feature your poetry because you have done so much for so many. And when did you know that you were born to communicate? But as a little five-year-old, can you look back and say, I see that in myself then?
Oh, I was writing poems at five. I had written a couple of poems. I remember I was traveling with my grandmother from San Francisco to Los Angeles, and we stopped at the beach, and I remember writing a poem about that, about finding sand dollars on the shore.
Was she wonderfully influencing, encouraging, supporting, or did you just go rogue?
No, supportive, but I wouldn't. I never was felt like I was pushed into anything. I was a kid who just spent a lot of time in the library and just would pull books off the shelf and just discover stuff. I mean, just
this is my
randomly.
Theory. This is my theory that writers are born. I swear they come out a certain way and they're going to go through the world looking for a way to decode language. I
discovered Edgar Allan Poe when I was in second grade, third grade, something like that. And I loved him.
I love you were born to be literary. And so be literary again and give us a poem. J.P. Dancing Bear, Awake and Alive from Oregon.
Okay, so this book also came out about a year before Oracles and Monsters, which is, this is actually two books. It's by, or came out from Salmon Press. It's Fish Singing Foxes. And I will read, I'll read Gisela Fish Singing Foxes, which is the title. And the Gisela poems, I should point out, are, I spent a lot of time with Lorca's Tamarit poems. And then I went back and kind of went to his influences and back into what ghazals were, which is what a ghazala is. It's just a ghazal. But it was his take on what ghazals were. And then I went forward and paid attention to the current modern ghazal writers, including Bly, who again had a completely different take on the way ghazals were formed.
Yeah, we have to stop and tell everyone that is a Persian form and you are elevating it through the century. So talk, just say a word about, we call it the ghazal, but I'm from the East Coast.
In traditional ghazal, or ghazal, the last, it's done in couplets, and then the last last phrase of the couplet is supposed to be repeated, and then at the end you're supposed to include your name somewhere in that final couplet.
Harder for some people than others.
Indeed.
Let's see what you did with it.
Okay, but this is not traditional. So this is my take on a traditional. So what I did was, basically, after reading all of these scholars and poets, that I focused on refrain and just making sure that there was a constant, repeating of words or phrases. And actually, throughout this entire book, you'll see the same thing. There are words, phrases, and images that are repeated. So this Gisela Fish Singing Foxes, and I wrote this for my publisher, Jesse Lindaney. The back door is left open again, and I don't care. I don't care if the leaves come inside and get warm in the kitchen. If you truly listen past the gurgle of the stream, you can hear fish singing foxes to the fish, like an open kitchen door. Out beyond the water is the song of grass. and the old poets' voices between the blades, the whistle of a fox tune. I know the door is open for the missing, but look at the congregation of leaves, singing the old fish songs. Just listen to what comes filling the void.
Oh, I could rest within that poem. Tell me what your connection is to an Irish publisher. Is it because you are reverent to nature? Do you find, is that the connection?
I happened to meet her in an online group about 20 years ago, and we just kind of started talking, and I'll tell you something. I was a fan of this publisher for years. Somebody gave me a book of Ray Bradbury's poems.
Salmon Press, right? Am I saying Salmon Press?
Yeah, Salmon Press. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Salmon Poetry, Salmon Press. She had published that book. And this was a signed copy that somebody had gotten for me. After that, I always, whenever I saw Salmon, I would pick up the book and read it. And I just began to trust them as a publisher. So I paid her the compliment, and she said, well, maybe we should do something.
Well, how many? You have more than one by Salmon.
Yes, three.
Yes, but I do believe it's appropriate. Because there is a tone with that press. I mean, all of her stuff is not eclectic. There is definitely a Salmon Press imprimatur. When you read the work, you know what she values.
Yeah. That's the way I used to feel, like Copper Canyon used to have that when Sam was still running it. And I trusted him as an editor. So.
What, did you know him?
I got to know him a little bit towards the end.
What a guy.
I had met him about, I guess, I'm going to say it was mid to late 2000s. He came and read in Santa Cruz, and then we just sort of kind of kept in touch, and then also in Facebook. I think he was out of Copper Canyon by that time.
But. Oh, yeah. I interviewed him in the 80s or 70s or something, but was a force. He was a force. Let's talk to another force. JP Dancing Bear, and here we want to hear you. We want to hear you.
Okay. So I have, like I said, this book is actually two books. I had two books that had won a bunch of awards, but not won a bunch of awards, but were finalists for a bunch of awards. And so they just kept kicking around for like 15 years. And finally, I just put them together, and Jesse said, yeah, let's do this. So the first half of it is a series of poems that take not the first or the last, but any middle lines from poems by my contemporaries. And I use that as a first line and then build a poem from there. So kind of what it shows is that a line doesn't have to be marred in a particular whatever. It's free to be whatever it wants to be. So you could take a single line and build an entirely new poem from it.
It's like a cento almost. A cento is where we take a line from this poet and then a line from that poet and a line from that poet and stack them up and get a new poem. Do you use that line like as an epigraph or by itself first?
I use it as the very first line in the poem. Sometimes it's the title, but then that is when the title is actually the first line.
That's a cool exercise. I'm going to do that for my workshop. Okay, go with it.
All right. This one is titled I Was, and it's a poem starting with a line from Megan O'Rourke. I was the snow that fell too soon. The wedding streamers in an empty room, the anagrammed heart spelling out one guilt, then pumping out doom. I was the sweet tooth, tooth's halo, the top memory of the weirdest worm in the killing jar. I was the whiner adept, bleeding at a streak down the gunmetal blue highway, looking for a pickup hand of poker. High stakes because the ground is for snakes and scorpions. No place to plot a victory party. I was counting the hangman's rosary beads, the skip and the tarnished link looking like what I had always believed mercy would embody, and a small filament of God. Oh, glorious string theory that binds one particle to my eye, be the light. And I was the shadow flickering on the wall, the one that grew too large and fell too soon.
Whoa. What is there in that poem that you think is in all of your poems? We're always saying the same thing over and over in a way. And what is it you're saying?
Well, I think what it is that there's a gravitas of life, of just the living. And all the day-to-day stuff has a gravitas. But oftentimes, I don't think we spend much time dwelling on it. We're caught up in, you know, the fluff and all the things that are flying loose and coming at us, and we just don't seem to pay attention to the ground.
But there's a huge spiritual hoist there. I mean, there's really a reverential tone to that poem. It's prayerful. And I think that that's significant in your work.
I do have a tendency to, I think poetry in a lot of ways is my religion. And so I do tend to think sometimes of poems as prayers, or at least having the quality of a prayer, sometimes a hymnal or a psalm, but definitely something along those lines.
Now, when you took that line from a previous poet, did that spark the content of the poem? Did you actually get inspired by that first line, or did you already have a lot of stuff incubating anyway? Or did that line trigger you?
My process basically when I write poems is I will fixate on a line or two. They will come into my head, and then I will rattle them around for days, kind of ruminating. Maybe this is where the spiritual, the prayer part of it comes in, is I will ruminate on those lines and let them start to build and fill out. And in this case, all I was doing was I was kind of using a starter pack, so to speak, by taking somebody else's line and then doing the same process, which is just to kind of ruminate it, just to let it bounce off of the inner wall of my head and echo and come back and, you know, do the phone game or whatever else needs to happen to make it.
Well, that's a good way to describe it. You know, you should write a few essays. Have you written essays?
I actually did write. There is an essay at the beginning of this book, which talks about the line is basically an on-ramp to the highway, so that, you know, you start off kind of slow and you pick yourself up and you keep going. And then I think, if I'm not mistaken, I did write one for the Gesellitz as well. Yeah, I did.
Valuable, very valuable stuff to pass on. But isn't obsession, we're the only people in the world that use it well. Because obsession could drive you crazy, but isn't it so necessary for us? That tool in the toolbox of going over and over a thought and cooking it. Would you want to be free of that ever?
No, because it's so a part of the way I think I just think about things in general. I apply it here as well in poetry. So if I get an idea, I tend to want to do the same thing, just kind of keep working at it and kind of forming it and kneading it until it starts to take a shape.
Well, let's see a product of this process, which is would be a J.P. Dancing Bear poem.
Okay, I'm going to go back to an earlier poem. I believe this is in Conflicted Light. In fact, I know it is because the title is from this poem. This is Natural Enemies. And I when I look at this poem now, I realize that I think I was messing around with the idea of gazelles a lot sooner than I really thought I was. All day the owl is dreaming of a crow, dreaming of a crow, dreaming of a crow and his war caw rushing through the pines. And the owl opens her mouth as if to say, wait, wait until nightfall. Until nightfall, when the crow's own blackness is not enough to hide him from her keen eyes. All night, the crow is dreaming of an owl, dreaming of an owl, dreaming of an owl, and battle screech, so close it could run through his dark body and sever his spine. His mouth moves in silence. Wait, wait until daybreak, when the owl's great camouflage cannot protect her from the murders of crows. In twilight, the owl and the crow are praying to live, praying to live, praying to live the long hours of hunting. They do not fly nor tempt the other into unowned time and orange territory of conflicted light. They bide, bide in their pine churches with their psalms to a god who would favor their feathers over the others.
Oh, I really love that. All day, the owl is dreaming of a crow. All night, the crow is dreaming of an owl. You know, it doesn't take much more than that to make me happy to be alive. That is, it gives me chills. That is a wonder. That is one of your best. That's one of your best.
People do tend to say that. And that's part of the reason why I picked it is because it is a favorite. I've been told many, many times.
And another favorite is what you do in the world. We have to mention Verse Daily. When did you begin that? Tell us what it is and what you do.
Well, I took it over about 6 years ago.
But tell everybody what it is.
What it is I like to consider it a kind of the poetry's anthology.
Mm-hmm. That's the writer's almanac of the day.
That's constantly, adding and building to. Generally what it is, it's always something that's been published someplace else. So it's either in book form or in a magazine. And basically what we're trying to do is we're trying to highlight and feature not only the writer's work, but also, the magazine that published it or the publisher's book. So just to let people know that there are other places to go, that there are resources, to go to certain magazines, to check things out. Most people, they have a very limited scope and view.
Who does that? I mean, you reached out to me from Little Patuxent Review. Who is reading all these magazines?
I am.
I am blown away. Blown away. So do you have time to do anything else in your life? I mean, this must take all day.
What I do is I set aside one day of the week to do the reading. Mm-hmm. And I start with a stack and I finish it. And then and I have a backlog, which only means I have no lack of resources.
We thank you. And we also wish to hear a final poem.
Okay. I'll read one from Fish Singing Foxes again. This is I'm not going to. I'm going to read one from Oracles and Monsters. I like to refer to this one, especially for writers, and especially as we dance on the on the edge of political uncertainty. So I had a chance to meet a Chinese dissident writer, and we talked for a bit, but I've known plenty of others. And so this poem refers to a lot of what happened there. This is the Oracle of Plutonian, and Pluto is Hades. And oftentimes there's a, it's the underworld. So it's those oracles were at the gates of the underworld, basically. So I'll start. Beneath a tangle of pomegranate branches, trying to reach the moon, I drifted into the valleys of sleep, near the dead and near dead, and came to rest beside a small pond. It's been more than a year, and I've been ill since the first night of visions, the night the writers were labeled enemies of the state. And I remembered the words of friends from totalitarian regimes who told me American poets were soft. They'd never been raided at 3 a.m., taken to a dank cell and beaten to confess whatever was in need of a confession. Too easy to be an American writer, and they all hoped it would stay that way now that they were granted asylum here. And I thought about my friends with black sacks on their heads, cuffed and tossed into vans. They fear, they told me, about never knowing who you'll see again or when. And how all your notebooks and journals will be gone to be used as evidence of your criminal thoughts. And you will hear each friend say, now write, now you will write, any way you can, you will write, in your head, on the walls, in dirt, even sand if you must, you will write, get one word out, wake the sleeping people, write their anthem.
Now you will write any way you can. The voice of J.P. Dancing Bear. This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. We're on remote. The program is produced by Forest Woods Media Productions. Post-production by Mike Turpin, MET Studios. We wish to thank the Library of Congress for making the program possible. Funding is provided by the Rivada Foundation of the Logan Family and the Sinopit Fund. I'm Grace Cavalieri. Our engineer is Mike Turpin.